The outlaws had discovered that the old house next door to Miss Hathaway was empty.
"I say," said William, "it'd be just the place for a meeting place, wouldn't it? Better in the old barn."
"Yes, but we'd have to be quieter," said Ginger,
"or else people'll be hearing us and making a fuss like what they always do." William knew Miss Hathaway, whose house overlooked the empty house. He had good cause to know her. Robert, William's grown-up brother, was deeply enamoured of Marion, Miss Hathaway's niece, and Miss Hathaway disapproved of Robert because he had no money and rode a very noisy motorcycle and dropped cigarette ash on her carpets. She disapproved of William still more, and for reasons too numerous to state. The empty house became the regular meeting place of the outlaws. They always entered cautiously by a hole in the garden hedge, first looking up and down the road to be sure that no one saw them. The house served many purposes besides that of meeting place. It was a smuggler's den, a castle, a desert island, and an Indian camp. It was William, of course, who suggested the midnight feast, and the idea was received with eager joy by the others. The next night they all got up and dressed when the rest of their households were in bed. Cautiously they made their way to the old house and entered it, disturbing several rats who fled at their approach. They sat around a stubby candle-end, thoughtfully provided by Henry. They ate sardines and buns and cheese and jam and cakes and desiccated coconut on the dusty floor in the empty upstairs room, whose paper hung in cobwebby strands from the wall, while rats squeaked indignantly behind the wainscoting, and the moon, pale with surprise, peeped in at the dirty, uncurtained window. They munched in happy silence and drank lemonade and licorice water provided by William.
"I say, let's do it tomorrow too," said Henry as they rose to depart, and the proposal was eagerly agreed to.
Miss Hathaway was a member of the Society for the Encouragement of Higher Thought. The Society for the Encouragement of Higher Thought had exhausted nearly every branch of higher thought. But last week someone had suggested psychical revelation.
"We must all collect data," said the president brightly.
"What's data?"
said little Miss Simpke to her neighbour in a mystified whisper.
"It's French for ghost story," said Miss Slooker.
"Oh,"
said little Miss Simpke, satisfied. The next meeting was at Miss Hathaway's house. The data were not very extensive.
"I'm afraid I've no personal experience to record," said little Miss Simpke, "but I've read some very exciting datas in magazines and such like, but I'm afraid they won't count."
Then Miss Hathaway, trembling with eagerness, spoke.
"I have a very important revelation to make," she said. "I have discovered that Colonel Hinks's old house is haunted."
There was a breathless silence. The eyes of the members of the Society for the Encouragement of Higher Thought almost fell through their spectacles onto the floor.
"Haunted!"
they screamed in chorus, and little Miss Simpke clung to her neighbour in terror.
"Listen," said Miss Hathaway. "The house is empty, yet I have heard voices and footsteps, the footsteps resembling Colonel Hinks's. Last night..."
The round-eyed, round-mouthed circle drew nearer.
"Last night I heard them most distinctly at midnight, and I firmly believe that Colonel Hinks's spirit is trying to attract my attention. I believe that he has a message for me."
Little Miss Simpke gave a shrill scream.
"Tonight I shall go there," said Miss Hathaway, "and I shall receive the message. I want you all to meet me here this time tomorrow, and I will report my experience."
"Oh, what a thrilling data it will make,"
breathed little Miss Simpke. William was creeping downstairs. It was too windy for him to use the pear tree that grew right up to his bedroom window, and he was going out by way of the dining room window. He was dressed in an overcoat over his pyjamas, and he held in his arms 10 small apples, which were his contribution to the feast. He looked round the moonlit hall. Ah, Robert's overflow bag. Robert had been staying with a friend and had returned late that night. He'd taken his suitcase upstairs and flung the small and shabby bag that he called his overflow bag down on a chair. It was still there. Good. It would do to hold the apples. William opened it. There were a few things inside, but William couldn't stay to take them out. There was plenty of room for the apples, anyway. He shoved them in, took up the bag, and made his way to the dining room window. The midnight feast was in full swing. Henry had forgotten to bring candles. Douglas was half asleep. Ginger was racked by gnawing internal pains as the result of the feast of the night before, and William was distrait. But otherwise, all was well. Someone had given William an old camera the day before, and his thoughts were full of it. He'd taken 6 snapshots and was going to develop them tomorrow. He'd sold his bow and arrows to a classmate to buy the necessary chemicals. As he munched the apples and cheesecakes and chocolate cream and pickled onions and currants provided for the feast, he was, in imagination, developing and fixing his snapshots. He'd never done it before. He thought he'd enjoy it. It would be so jolly and messy, watery stuff to slosh about in little basins and that kind of thing. Suddenly, as they munched and lazily discussed the rival merits of catapults and bows and arrows, there came through the silent, empty house the sound of the opening of the front door. The outlaws stared at each other with crummy mouths wide open. Steps were now ascending the front stairs. Suddenly, a loud and vibrant voice called from the middle of the stairs. "Speak!" It made the outlaws start almost out of their skins. "Speak! Give me your message!" The hair of the outlaws stood on end.
A ghost!" whispered Henry with chattering teeth. "Crikey!" said William. "Let's get out!"
They crept silently out of the further door, down the back stairs, out of the window, and fled with all their might down the road. Meanwhile, upstairs, Miss Hatherley first walked majestically into the closed door and then fell over Robert's overflow bag, which the outlaws had forgotten in their panic. Robert went to see his beloved Marion next day to reassure her of his undying affection. She yawned several times in the course of his speech. She was beginning to find Robert's devotion somewhat monotonous. "I say," she said, interrupting him as he was telling her that he'd made up a lot more poetry about her but had forgotten to bring it, "I say, do come indoors. They're having some sort of stunt in the drawing room. Aunt and the High Thinkers, you know. I'm not quite sure what it is. Something psychic," she said, "but anyway, it ought to be amusing." Rather reluctantly, Robert followed her into the drawing room where the Higher Thinkers were assembled. The Higher Thinkers looked coldly at Robert. He wasn't much thought of in high-thinking circles. There was an air of intense excitement in the room as Miss Hatherley rose to speak.
I entered the haunted house," she began in a low, quivering voice, "and at once I heard voices."
Miss Simke clung in panic to Miss Sluka.
I proceeded up the stairs, and I heard footsteps. I went on undaunted.
The Higher Thinkers gave a thrilled murmur of admiration.
And suddenly all was silent, but I felt a presence. It led me along a passage. I felt it. It led me to a room.
Miss Simke screamed again.
And in the room I found this.
With a dramatic gesture, she brought out Robert's overflow bag.
I have not yet investigated it. I wished to do so first in your presence. I feel sure that this is what Colonel Hinks has been trying to show me. I am convinced that this will throw light upon the mystery of his death. I am now going to open it.
If it's human remains, quavered Miss Simke, I shall faint.
With a determined look, Miss Hatherley opened the bag. From it she brought out, first, a pair of faded and very much darned blue socks. Next, a shirt with a large hole in it. Next, a bathing suit. And lastly, a pair of very grimy white flannel trousers. The Higher Thinkers looked bewildered. But Miss Hatherley was not daunted.
They're clues! Clues! They must have some meaning. Here's a notebook. This will explain everything.
She opened the notebook and began to read aloud.
Oh, Marion, my lady fair, has eyes of blue and golden hair. Her heart of gold is kind and true. She is the sweetest girl you ever knew. But, oh, a dragon guards this jewel, a hideous dragon, foul and cruel. The ugliest old thing you ever did see is Marion's aunt, Miss Hatherley. What?
These socks are both marked Robert Brown, suddenly cried Miss Slooker, who'd been examining the clues. Miss Hatherley gave a scream of rage and turned to the corner where Robert had been, but Robert had vanished.
When Robert saw his overflow bag, he had turned red. When he saw his socks, he had turned purple. When he saw his shirt, he had turned green. When he saw his trousers, he had turned white. When he saw his notebook, he had turned yellow. When Miss Hatherley began to read, he had muttered something about feeling faint and crept unostentatiously out of the window. Marion followed him.
"Well," she said sternly, "you've made a nice mess of everything, haven't you? What on earth have you been doing?"
I can't think what you thought of those old clothes," said Robert. "I never wear them. I don't know why they were in the bag."
"Oh, do shut up about your things," snapped Marion. "I don't care what you wear, but I'm sick with your writing soppy poetry about me for those asses to read. And why did you give her your bag, you loony?"
I didn't, Marion," said Robert miserably. "It's a mystery to me how she got it. I've been hunting for it high and low all today. It's simply a mystery."
"Oh, do stop saying that. What are you going to do about it? That's the point."
I'm going to commit suicide," said Robert. "I feel there's nothing left to live for now you're turning against me."
"I don't believe you could," said Marion aggressively.
"How are you going to do it?"
"I shall drink poison."
"What poison?"
"I don't believe you know what are poisons."
"What poison?"
"Prussic acid," said Robert.
"Well, you couldn't get it. They wouldn't sell it to you."
"People do get poisons," Robert said indignantly. "I'm always reading of people taking poisons."
They had reached Robert's house and were standing just beneath William's window.
"I know heaps of poisons," said Robert. "I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to take. I'm going to..."
At that moment, William, who had been fixing his snapshots and was beginning to clear up, threw the contents of his fixing bath out of the window with a careless flourish. They fell upon Robert and Marion. For a minute, they were both speechless with surprise and solution of sodium hydrosulfate. Then Marion said furiously,
"You brute! I hate you!"
"Oh, I say," gasped Robert, "it's not my fault, Marion. I don't know what it is. Honestly, I didn't do it."
Some of the solution had found its way into Robert's mouth, and he was trying to eject it as politely as possible.
"It came from your beastly house," said Marion angrily, "and it's ruined my hat, and I hate you, and I'll never speak to you again."
She turned on her heel and walked off, mopping the back of her neck with a handkerchief as she went. Robert stared at her unrelenting back till she was out of sight, then went indoors. Ruined her hat, indeed.
What was a hat, anyway? It had ruined his suit, simply ruined it. And how had the old cat got his bag, he'd like to know. He wouldn't mind betting a quid that that little wretch William had had something to do with it. He always had.
He decided not to commit suicide after all. He decided to live for years and years and years to make the little wretch's life a misery to him, if he could.